was a very big Chobbuck, Walter Brown's model. I know you heard about it. But I find very interesting growing up. Is that something you agree with, or I haven't read a whole lot on this?
Okay, Walter Brown's model. How many have heard of Walter Brown? Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got a model called the hydroplane theory. And he explains the features you see in geology by the Atlantic raising up in the plates of 16-mile thick granite that goes sliding off real fast, so forth and so on. I think it's and he has lots of other, he tries to explain everything from this model. Even
the water shooting up along this place.
Okay, one of them is the water shoots up along the mid-ocean ridges. Within 2 hours, it's shooting up, and a lot of it is ejected out to outer space, forming the comets and asteroids, but a lot of it comes down also, and somehow it gets frozen. It freezes up there, and then it stays frozen. When it hits the ground, it freezes the woolly mammoth system. That's probably what you're thinking of. But that's one aspect. He has the origin of the Grand Canyon and the order of the fossil record. He has lots of things he tries to explain. I think the model has lots of problems. And if you want to know why, my reasons why, I wrote a 13,000-word analysis of his model that's on creation.com. It came out in March of 2013. So look on the creation.com website, and you can see many reasons why I find this model has many, many problems.
Good question.
Here's one right here.
You were talking about the decrease in the global temperature in the 70s. Do you believe it's kind of going up and down, like over the grand scale?
Oh, yeah. We can, by proxy, what's called proxy indicators from ice cores and tree rings, we know that we had a warm period called the medieval warm period between about 800 AD and 1200, 1300 AD. And then from about 1300 AD to 1880, we had the Little Ice Age, where all the glaciers in the world advanced. When I showed you that picture of the Columbia ice fields, where it was at 1890, well, it had to advance up to that point. And so all the glaciers in the world advanced. In fact, it covered up parts of some villages in Switzerland. There's some kind of entertaining scenarios you can read about priests getting out there and trying to do something to stop it, but it kept coming into the city. But anyway, so the upshot of this is we've had climate changes for long periods that we can trace, and they're generally correlated to effects on the sun. And in the 20th century, we can correlate effects on the sun much better than increase in carbon dioxide. That's why you can say, based on the relationships, correlations as we call them, in the 20th century, that natural processes on the sun are more than 50% of the global warming. And we're in the warm cycle presently. Actually, in the last 15 years, we've kind of flattened out. How many have heard that we're not warming in the last 15 years? It's been pretty flat. Most of you have heard that. It's kind of interesting. I'm trying to explain this. CO2 is really shooting up, by the way. So they really go to extreme lengths to try to explain this problem. So did I answer the question? I embellished a lot.
I read your book, Flood by Design.
Flood by Design?
Yeah, okay. I loved that book. It just really opened my eyes. I've wondered about the topography of this area since I was a kid. And I've just seen it in whole new eyes now since I've read your book. But, and by the way, I wish you had given it a different title, like geophysical morphological evidence for the flood or something like that.
That's not my title. The real title is on the bottom. Feeding Watersheds. Master Books gave me that title.
Okay. Anyway, it's because it's a hard book to give to a non-Christian to read because of the title, I think. But
it kind of just credits it
in their mind before they even open the cover, you know. So I wish you would have called it Geomorphological Evidence for the Flood or something. But anyway, in that book, you basically state that you believe the Grand Canyon was a result of flood runoff because of the side canyons, that sort of thing, which makes sense to me. And I'm just wondering what you think of the Lake Mistula flood, why you don't think the same thing about it. Or do you?
Okay. You brought a lot of ideas in my mind. First of all, the book Flood by Design, which I believe is on the back, is actually the abridged edition. I got a 1,000-page e-book free on my website on that same subject, all with color pictures. So a lot more detail. And then getting into Grand Canyon, I believe Grand Canyon's a water gap. Like, we have thousands of them across the earth, lots of them in the western U.S., like the Green River goes, the Green River goes through the eastern Uinta Mountains in a half-mile-deep slot canyon, but it could have easily gone around. I mean, that's called a water gap. It's a gorge through mountains. Well, when did water gaps form during the flood? Well, you could show that they formed late in the flood by currents going perpendicular to ridges and rapidly cutting down gorges. And so Grand Canyon fits that pattern very well. But the Lake Missoula flood is a totally different thing. It happened at the peak of the ice age. Because we had to have ice 2,500 feet deep to cause a lake 2,000 feet deep in the valleys of western Montana by blocking the Clark Fork River. Because you had melt off during summer melting late in the ice age, you know, the lake would build up and finally it just burst through that ice dam. So that is a real dam breach. And I'm probably a few creation scientists have studied a real dam breach. So that's why when I study Grand Canyon, I don't see evidence for a dam breach through hard rock. Especially when there's lots of problems. And by the way, I have an e-book you can get on the origin of the Grand Canyon. It's on the creationresearch.org website. See, is it up there?
Yeah.
Under creationresearch.org, you can get an ebook on the origin of the Grand Canyon, and I go through it in a lot of detail. It's about 300-page ebook, small pages.
Why do you think that the Mississippi or the Washington State skylines, why were they not formed and run off from the flood? Why do you think they were formed later?
Okay, first of all, you go into the valleys of western Montana, you see all these strand lines, which are shorelines from Glacier Lake Missoula. They're all over. They're just not around Missoula. They're all over those valleys. And you have features that are like gravel bars around current streams. You don't see these features associated with the Genesis Flood. The Genesis Flood, I think the currents were a lot more rapid and wide, and they were different. So they have different features they left on the surface of the earth. The features left by the Lake Missoula Flood are quite different. They're superficial, like a 10-story high gravel bar. In the water has to be at least twice that height, usually. You also see other strange features, like in the central Washington, you see a channel that's in soft rocks of a certain formation. I can't remember it, but it doesn't matter. And it comes out as a hanging valley over the Columbia River, about several hundred feet. Well, if that was a normal stream, it would cut down, but it has to be a flood with a large flood with a waterfall. And also, you have all those erratic boulders all through eastern Washington. I showed you one that was southwest of Portland. There's also hundreds of other erratic boulders in the Willamette Valley, clear to Eugene, Oregon. That archelite boulder couldn't have been rolled by the Genesis flood waters. Even though it's a hardened shale, it'll still break up rolling, and it's very angular looking. When water easily rounds rocks. So the evidence that it had to be placed by an iceberg is just overwhelming. So there's just a lot of evidence that it's a post-flood effect of the Ice Age.
In Australia, that Ayers Rock,
yes.
Would that have been like an erratic too?
No. I've read where some people have mistaken it, but it's not. What it is what you're seeing is the tip of the iceberg sort of, you are seeing, it's vertical. It's vertical sandstone. First of all, it's a special type of sandstone called, I can't think of the name, but it's a high feldspar sandstone. When feldspar weathers rapidly, so this sandstone had to be deposited rapidly. And you're seeing about 1,100 feet of the vertical part, and it represents a formation that goes down something like 3 or 4,000 meters down below the ground. So you're just seeing actually the tip of the iceberg, in a way, of a formation. And the formation was sand that was laid down over a wide area like this, and cement was moving through the pores. Sand is mostly 50% air a lot of times, loose sand. But when you compress it and you put cement in it, you have to put 30% of the volume has to be cement, and it still has a lot of air in it. So you have to cement it first, and then you have to bow it up like this, just shear it off like that, and leaving a little piece there called Ayers Rock sticking up 1,100 feet. That's the catastrophism you see based on Ayers Rock.
I was born in the Caribbean, on the little island of Barbados. I just wondered, is it a good investment to buy a house on the sand near the seashore? Would it be good for about 30 years or so?
Barbados is rising.
I was just wondering, you showed a chart there where you had the ocean temperature at 70 degrees at one point.
30 degrees centigrade.
30
degrees centigrade.
Yeah, and then it dropped down to minus 4 average ocean temperature.
Yeah, eventually. But
How did you come up with that number? And secondly, what would be the air temperature if the ocean temperature is?
Oh, yeah, I had to do this for the air because the effects affected the air. Okay, you have heating and cooling terms for the ocean water, for the whole ocean. The main cooling term, which is 3/4 of the cooling, is by evaporation. Evaporation is a powerful cooling mechanism. And so, especially when you have cool air from land going over warm water, you have powerful evaporation, especially along the east coast of the continents. And that evaporation is a powerful cooling mechanism. So that's your main cooling mechanism. Another cooling mechanism, which is about 25%, is when you have cold air moving over warm water. And just the cold air will warm and the warm water will cool. So those are two ways you cool the ocean. The heating terms are solar radiation. Your sunshine is your main heating term for the ocean. Also, you have some infrared radiation cooling the ocean surface. So you add up all these terms, estimate them for the Ice Age, and you get the change in temperature, change in time. And so I estimated the change in temperature 20 degrees centigrade, and it solved for change in time. Just it's an algebra, just algebraic equation. Kind of got the gist of it.
Well, I just imagine the ocean temperature being 30 degrees.
It
must be mighty hot.
You know, they run these climate models, you know, where they raise the ocean temperature maybe 4 degrees centigrade, and it just gets wild effects. Huge amount of evaporation. Thunderstorms develop quickly. I mean, this is a radical. You can't even model this yet. Because
my question is, I'm just wondering, was it so hot? Could anybody live in that environment?
Oh, 30 degrees centigrade ocean water? Well,
the atmospheric temperature, the air temperature.
Oh, it would heat the air up. But remember, you have cooling from the volcanism, so the interiors of continents would be cool in the summer. But you know, like Seattle, Washington, or Vancouver here, your temperatures would probably easily be in the 80s. You'd be warm for a while. You wouldn't have ice for quite a while until the ocean's cooled enough because of the onshore flow of warm, moist air. Your mountains would be where it glaciated. You'd probably get 50 feet of snow, of pure ice, in 1 year. It'd be so fast, so much moisture from a warm ocean in the Gulf of Alaska, that you'd glaciate the mountains rapidly. And that would descend to the valleys eventually. And as the ocean's cooled, it can get down into Vancouver here, probably midway in the Ice Age. And the same thing with British Columbia. The British Isles. This solves a major mystery, too, in that you, in 100 locations in England, you find hippopotamus fossils in Ice Age deposits with reindeer, woolly mammoths, and other cool climate animals. Hippos! What are hippos doing in England during the Ice Age? Well, warm ocean, warm onshore flow from currents going air currents going from west to east. The air gets heated up by the ocean, so you have warm, moist air hitting Britain. It'd be much wetter than it is today, and warmer. It'd be a great environment for a hippo coming from the mountains of Ararat as they descended down and spread. You know, there's lots of them. In by the way, in Western Germany and France, you find those fossils, but especially in England. 100 locations, so things are fitting together.
Just a simple question. I've always been interested in a little bit of geology and so on. You say then that glacial till is undifferentiated material. Is that?
Yeah, essentially it's glacial debris left by the glacier, rocks, sand, so sometimes clay. Just a lot of different stuff in a big mixture.
And so that you could easily tell the difference between what was glaciated and what was laid down by the flood?
No, sometimes you can't. Remember those ancient ice ages, hundreds of millions of years ago, they claimed from the rocks? That looks like glacial till. But you could duplicate glacial till by landslides. But because the glacial till's in the surface of the plains, all over the plains, you can't evoke landslides. Where would they come from to deposit in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, etc.? So that's a lot different than what you see in the hard rocks. Landslides will actually duplicate what you see in glacial till.
So, but what was laid down during the flood, you would see it differentiated, fines and then a lot of... larger gravels and so on?
It's interesting. You don't find a lot of gravel from the flood. 80% of your sedimentary rocks are shales and mudstones, fine-grained particles. And then I think it's 12% are sandstones and 8% limestones, which is a chemical sediment. But the fact that you don't find many conglomerates, you do find some, of course, is very interesting. It implies that when you eroded the top of the pre-flood world, you must have really mixed that stuff up and just broke it up into fine particles. So tremendous turbulence must have been involved for that. Did I answer your question, or did I get off on a rabbit trail?
Well, that was good that you did, because it just gave some other thoughts. But I worked for a number of years as a building inspector, and I always used to look at the excavations of houses. People called certain materials glacial till.
Yeah,
but it was all clay. It was just clay.
Well, it can be clay, but it should have some stones in it if it's really glacial till. Otherwise, it can be lake bottom sediments. A lot of clays are found where we had ice age lakes. You had a lot of lakes dammed up against the edge of the ice. See, a lot of times the ice depressed the land down, and so it kind of drained. And backed up or backed on, banked against the ice. And that deposited a lot of clay. Those things deposit clay mostly. So clay necessarily isn't till, but if it has some rocks in it, it could be till. But even that could be lake bottom sediments. And they made some mistakes in the past. I think in the Midwest, some of those. Clay deposits, they used to separate into four ice ages. I think what they're seeing, they're not seeing a glacial till when they find clay with stones in them, but actually glacial lacustrine or glacial lake features. And so I think there's been a lot of mistakes made in the U.S. Midwest out there. But just because you find clay doesn't mean it's glacial till. Could be, though.
I think we'll just take two more questions then.
I was quite interested in that part where you were showing us where the Ice Age was. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what varied the temperature so much that part of places like England were like totally iced over and others were like totally untouched.
Oh, it depends on a lot of variables. Latitude, altitude, how close you were to the warm water, whether you're on the east side of a continent versus the west side. See, generally your atmospheric flows from west to east. So the west sides of your continents are going to have onshore flow, east side's offshore flow. So your ice is going to develop pretty fast in southeast Canada and northeast United States, but very slow in the lowlands of western British Columbia. It'll start in your mountains first. And then it'll descend to the lowlands with time. So it's a very dynamic, changing pattern of the ice. And so you have to analyze every spot on its own merits based on lots of variables, lots of meteorological variables.
Appreciate it. All over the world, things are going on, and it's not one answer for all. But the speed, like, you know, I forgot the picture. Noah gets off the ark, it's pretty warm.
Yes.
But up where the frozen mammoths, of course, these other models, the Christian models, have been trying to say why the mammoths have still had food in them. Mm-hmm. They look frozen, yeah. And it was like they thrown into a freezer at minus 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Your model here that you're explaining, it has, with that whole freezing process take that much?
Well, you can read all about it in the book.
I
will give you a one-minute answer.
What book has that as well?
Oh, let's see. Frozen in Time, okay. The Woolly Mammoths, the Ice Age, and the Biblical Key to the Secrets. That focuses especially on the woolly mammoth and all the mysteries. First of all, you've got to understand how many carcasses are we talking about. Frozen mammoths, very small, less than 100. And they're predominantly skeletons and tusks. And they show evidence that they died natural deaths and were frozen pretty fast. And even those with stomach contents, you can identify some of the vegetation, sometimes food in their mouth. You know, I mean, they'd have to be frozen fast, fairly fast, but nothing like 150 degrees Fahrenheit below zero suddenly. And they're living in a temperate climate before that. There's lots of ideas that are kind of super catastrophic on these. Secular scientists have dreamed up some of these pole shifts, the crust sliding from the south to the north, the freezing suddenly. I mean, Velikovsky had this idea of Mars and Jupiter moving through the solar system and coming near the Earth and causing all kinds of havoc. So there's lots of ideas out there. Walter Brown has his idea, but I have mine, and I'm from the data that I analyzed.
Okay, thank you very much. Mike?